The Byron Bay Blues Fest is Australia's premier blues and roots music festival, with roots going all the way back to 1990. Festival director Peter Noble first worked on the festival in 1994, and he's owned it since 2008. Blues Fest has hosted, well, more or less everyone, but the likes of Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, James Brown, Angelique Kidjo and B.B. King, just to name a few of the many stars who've been through Blues Fest over the years. The pandemic meant that the 31st Blues Fest had to be cancelled. And after the shocker of 2020, it was particularly devastating that the 2021 Blues Fest was cancelled by a public health order just one day before it was supposed to start earlier this year in April, a decision that caused an estimated $10 million of loss to the festival. So it's been a rocky 18 months for Peter Noble, but he has been an irrepressible part of the music industry in Australia and around the world for decades. So to tell us about his legendary career, and with fingers and toes crossed throughout for the return of Blues Fest in October 2021, Peter Noble, welcome to the year that made me.
Thank you, Julian. Wow, what an introduction.
Well, it's great to be speaking with you. You've been in the music industry for almost half a century now. Is there a job or role in the industry that you haven't done by this point?
Not much. I've gone out there and put posters up on walls, and I've managed artists. I've started a record label and festivals. I'm a tour promoter. What else haven't I done? I don't know. I've been a professional musician.
Well, that's right. Well, and that's where you really started in the industry. Can you tell us how you came to be a professional musician and maybe a few war stories from those early years?
Well, there was a time, a long time ago, when the Brits just took over the world, and it was the Beatles first and then the Rolling Stones, and everybody wanted to grow their hair and get your mates and go, well, you be the drummer and you be the bass player. Be a garage band and hopefully ultimately rent the local scout hall and get some girls to come along. Let's be honest. If you're standing on the stage, you were the attraction. And I was very fortunate. The neighborhood band that I had was always looking for a singer, and we auditioned, and the Scottish guy came along and we just said, oh, you're in the band. You're in the band. He said, no, I'm not. I don't want to join. But as I was packing my bass away in my car, he walked up to me and he said, I'm putting together a band. Do you want to join it? And back there in Sydney around the Burwood area, there were so many British migrants. That's where the Easy Beats started from, and John English and AC/DC, or the Bee Gees lived in Strathfield. And they came down from Brisbane. And so I was the only Aussie in an old Brit band called Clapham Junction. And I'll tell you what, we've still got fans to this day. We were very successful in Sydney, and we used to tour up throughout New South Wales and Brisbane. So that's how I got into the business in the 60s.
Peter, do you recognise this track, which I was able to track down on YouTube? Well, we might throw it over to our guest on the year that made me, Peter Noble, to back announce that track.
You know, can I just tell you a quick story about that band?
Please do.
Members of that band went on to form a band called Sherbet.
And oh, right. I've heard of Sherbet. Yes, indeed.
You heard of them?
And the singer in
that band,
of course,
went on to become AC/DC's first manager.
Wow. There you go. The track there is Emily on a Sunday by Clapham Junction. So what was your role in the band, Peter? And were we hearing your vocals there?
Yeah, you heard my backing vocals. I was the bass player. And I ended up being the guy that used to go and meet with the agents about getting more bookings. So I guess right from the beginning, I was the business guy in the band.
Yeah, right.
But as I say, one member of the band went on to manage AC/DC, so he did even better than I did at the time.
Playing music professionally saw you leave Australia, and you lived in the US and Canada for a while. The year that you've chosen as the year that made you, Peter Noble, was 1978. Why did you choose that year?
Well, because I'd been touring with bands in the US, and I was playing in a a mixed race band of people who were either Chicano, or we had four black members. We couldn't get a lot of work in many parts of the US where we wanted to play. You could always get gigs in the black part of town, but they paid a lot less. And so we ended up being a band that mainly toured Canada. And they fired me. And they dropped me at the side of the road in Portland, Oregon, with my bass and my bag. Luckily, I knew somebody there that put me up for a few days. But I was without a gig, and I didn't have any money. It was 1978. So I walked down the street, and I saw this sign that said American Entertainment. And I walked in, and I said to the man, you know what? I can book your bands. Because that's what I'd been doing in this band that I was in called Stormy Weather. You know, I get in touch with the agents, and I do all the follow-up work. So I don't know what happened to Stormy Weather after they fired me. I never heard from them again. But anyway. And I said, hey, look, all you've got to do is get me a room and buy me breakfast and put me on commission. And God bless the man, he did.
Was this how you became the booker for The Earth?
There was an agent in Victoria, British Columbia, Paul Mascioli. And Paul had some dates with two very well-known jazz guitarists at the time, Herb Ellis and Barney Kessel. Herb was, if you remember, the guitar player with Oscar Peterson Trio. Barney Kessel was a member of the Wrecking Crew, if you know who they are. And, you know, that critical band of session musicians in LA that played on everything, from Brian Wilson to Phil Spector to... Anyway, they were coming. He had an extra show. We needed $500 and said, can you get me a date somewhere there in Portland? And I set up a date in a club, and by my memory, we took over $3,000. So all of a sudden, I was the golden boy. And within a few months, I had people investing enough to put B.B. King on. It was just a very instant thing from being an agent for a couple of months to being a promoter almost immediately. And so all of a sudden, I'm booking everybody from John Lee Hooker to the Ramones to even the Police on their way up. So that's why 78 was my year, because I went from being a musician for the previous 12 years to, you know, going into the dark side, if you know what I mean.
And Peter, 1978 was also, I believe, the year you set up the first international jazz festival in Portland, Oregon. Is that right?
Oh, I did. I did, with acts like Stanley Turrentine and all sorts of great artists. It was a wonderful thing, a learning experience for me to be able to be in touch with the agents for talent. And because I came from a background of being a musician, it wasn't for me always about just having the popular bands of the day. It was about having the great artists. And I got to work with people like Sun Ra, Mongo Santa Maria, like I said, Stanley Turrentine. I could go on, Dave Edmunds, and just so many great bands from that time. So when I came back to Australia in 1979, I was lucky enough to meet the people at the Basement in Sydney, and they invested in me, and boom, next minute we're bringing artists like Charlie Bird, Earl Father Hines, and Jimmy Witherspoon, and all those jazz artists that came to the Basement at the time. They funded me in doing it, and I figured out how to do tours. So I started out in Australia pretty much as a jazz promoter and blues, but I soon moved into other areas, and particularly reggae. And yeah, I've always loved all those black music forms. But I also worked with acts like The Sweet, and I used to tour Canteens, and we used to do 50-date tours of Australia. Can you believe that? Can you imagine that happening anymore?
Well, Peter, as well as tours and festivals, you also founded your own label. And indeed, it was the first Australian label to win a Grammy Award back in 2008 in a very interesting category. Indeed, 2008 was the first time that a Grammy had been awarded for Cajun music. How does an Australian label end up producing the best Zydeco, is it, album of 2008?
Yes, the Cajun and Zydeco music is the music of Southwest Louisiana. And I happened to they were making a movie in New York, Crocodile Dundee 2, and I was very friendly with some of the guys on the crew, and we went out for a night. And believe me, gee, the New Yorkers loved the people working on that movie. We were ushered to the front of every long line, but we ended up at some point in the night in a place called the Lone Star Cafe, very drunk, Aussies, and the band playing was Terence Simeon and his Zydeco experience. And somewhere during that night, a drunken Peter Noble walked up to him and said, "I'm going to bring you to Australia, mate." And and I ended up bringing him to Australia about 1994. And we became firm friends, and he cut a couple of albums. And my record label is, I used to cut a lot of albums in New Orleans. And so with different artists from the Mardi Gras Indians called the Wild Magnolias through to soul artists like Marva Wright and many, many recordings. But Terrence always had that golden voice. To me, he had the next best voice in Louisiana to Aaron Neville, who I didn't get to record. He was on a major label. So we cut a number of albums, and as the Grammys decided to have a Cajun and Zydeco Grammy, and Zydeco was like the black music, French-speaking people from the swamps of southwest Louisiana, Cajun's the white music of that area, French-speaking again. And we cut the album in Lafayette, and Terrence was also on that album that Paul Simon made, the one that brought all the world music to the fore.
Graceland, was it?
Graceland is it.
Yes, there you go.
So you remember because standing on the corner in Lafayette, Terrence is on that. But anyway, we won the Grammy. And I didn't go to LA at the time because I didn't have a lot of money, and I went, gee, I don't want to fly all that way and we don't win it. So I've learned something over the years. Whenever I don't go to an awards night, we generally win.
Right, okay. So do you make it a point of not attending when you're nominated these days?
No, I'm doing my best. Well, I don't get nominated that many anymore. But that same year, we were also nominated for another album that I cut in Havana with Cubanismo, which we call Greetings from Havana. And Cubanismo was a great Cuban band that Jesus Alemany, the trumpet player, and, of course, that band was one that toured the US all the time, except when there was a Republican president and they found some reason not to give them visas. But but anyway, Juan DeMarcos, do you know him? The guy that
I don't know Juan DeMarcos. Oh, right. Yeah, of course. Yes, yes.
Yes, he's the guy that produced that album, really. It wasn't Ry Cooder. He's the one that got all the musicians together. It wasn't Ry Cooder. But Juan used to come by my hotel every morning in Havana and go, "Have you got anything I can hear from the previous night?" Because him and Jesus were the two great Cuban musicians who were always in competition with each other, and I was friends with both of them. And so, but anyway, yes, that was nominated for a Tropical Latin Grammy, but we didn't win. So it was a great year for my label, though. Nominated for two Grammys, winning one.
And you've produced over 200 albums through the AIM Records label. We're speaking with Peter Noble, the festival director and owner of Byron Bay Blues Fest. Peter, over the years, there's obviously just been so many extraordinary acts that have come through Blues Fest. Are there particular personal highlights that you have from Blues Fest over the years?
Oh, yes, there are. There's a long list, but I was always very proud to be able to work with James Brown. Mm. And James had going into that tour, I think the year was 2004, he'd had an incident where he was arrested, and we all saw that photograph of him with being in the James Brown mode with all his hair looking all nappy and all that. And so we did have some real issues going into that tour because it'd been for assaulting his wife. And I always remember that I was the tour promoter, that when we were in Auckland for the first show, we were in this hotel, which is an open atrium type of a hotel, and I got in there in the afternoon before the show, and I'm looking around going, "Where's the musicians? Oh my, don't tell me they haven't come. Don't tell me they haven't, you know." And I call my rep there, and he said, "No, they're all in their rooms." But because of all that publicity and James being up on a charge in America and we having some issues in getting the visas issued, James had just told them all, "You're not allowed to leave your rooms. You have to get room service." And the threat was, you know, "You'll be on the next plane home if you do." So we only ever saw the musicians when they went to the rehearsal, the sound check, and played the next night. And that show that James did, and I've seen him play a few times before, that was the best show I've ever seen him do. And I think one thing you could always say about James Brown, without approving what he did, that you put him in the corner, he will come out like Muhammad Ali. if you know what I mean.
The absolutely real electric great, live performer, yes.
Great man that he was. The way he danced, even in his latter years, you could see where Michael Jackson got it from. And, yeah, and Michael would be the first to have told you that. But he was one of the greats for me. And the show he did at Blues Fest, he never left the stage for a minute. It was great. And that was around the time, a couple of years before that, that Midnight Oil played Blues Fest. And that was another of those great shows. It's an occasion. And that's what I love at Blues Fest, where you can you try to build that every year in a festival. But to get those artists that take it from being an event or festival into an occasion.
Absolutely.
We've had years with Zac Brown Band or Santana. In fact, Santana played before Zac Brown Band one year, I think it was 2017, and the artist before that was Buddy Guy. And I'm only talking one stage.
When you look at the list of people who've performed over the years, it is truly extraordinary, Peter. Blues Fest has had so many highlights. Was the second cancellation in April 2021, was that the lowest point for Blues Fest?
Because we weren't what you would call a commercial music festival, we were really more of a group of genres. We often struggled in the early years to make a profit. And so my memories back then was every year, can we get to the next one?
Mm.
You know, for the first 10 or so years, we weren't making any money. People thought we were because they'd see the number of people attending, but they didn't know how much it cost us. And that's the issue with festivals. They cost a lot of money to put on. So I just really felt when we got cancelled in 2020, rightfully, 3 weeks out, with COVID descending upon us, that the first thing we had to do was start working on the next year's event. And so really by April, within a month, 3 weeks of getting cancelled, we were working on the Easter 2021 event. That meant devising the first major COVID safety plan for major events, which we did, and we did get approved, and it was at a very high level. It meant dealing with everything that was needed to do an event in a COVID world, fully seated events, initially all outdoor stages, although we were able to get an approval to put open-sided circus tents up.
So it must have just been devastating when the order came through.
We were ready and we put a year's work into it, 14 months work in.
Absolutely. Peter, we've certainly got our fingers crossed for the return of Blues Fest in October, and it'll be great to see the tradition of Blues Fest continuing. We always do finish the year that made me by asking our guest for a piece of music, and I think of all the guests we've had, there's no one with more to choose from than you. So what piece of music should we go out with on the year that made me for you, Peter Noble?
Well, I was Toots of Toots and the Maytals promoter for nearly 30 years, and we only lost him last year. And he always had this song, and I always had the title of it wrong in my mind. I thought it was called Holding Up the Big Ones Behind. In other words, you know, those artists in front of me are holding me back and I'm going to get in front of you. But then I found out the title was Monkey Man.
Well, there you go. Either would be a good title, Peter, absolutely. But let's hear it by its official title, Monkey Man. Peter Noble, thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you, Julian. Really appreciate
it. And here it is, Toots and the Maytals, Monkey Man.
Big monkey man, I see no sign of you. I hold